Your mother and I have been talking, and we've come to the realization that we've not been very good parents.
Sadly, and most of the time, we have no interest in what's going on with you.
We have no idea what's, because she means no idea. We have lost touch as a family. And if we're going to get through this ordeal together, we have got to get reacquainted. Now, back at Rose Video, we had management retreats where we would play fun team building.
You also had company-wide spa days. Why don't we try that?
And one of the icebreakers at these retreats was a game that was always a hit. And it was a game where somebody would tell a lie about themselves, and then a truth, and then another lie, and everybody would have to guess which one was the lie.
No, Johnny, they had to guess which one was the truth.
Which one was the lie?
It's just one lie.
What did I say?
You said two lies.
Well, it is two lies.
No, the game is two truths and a lie.
It's true. So you've heard of it.
Yeah, because babies play that at their birthday parties.
Okay, whatever. It's a good game.
Babies
okay?
play it at
now, here's how it goes. I'll give you an example.
Why don't I start? I'm miserable, drunk, and hate this game. So, here's a hint. Sadly, I'm not drunk.
Okay, wrong attitude.
All right, it's Dave Player back with you here on 720 WGN. When we say TV sitcom Schitt's Creek won every comedy category announced at the Emmys this past week, we mean every single one. In addition to winning Outstanding Comedy Series, Dan Levy, who stars as David Rose and co-created the show with his father, Eugene Levy, won separate awards for writing, directing, and Outstanding Supporting Actor. Eugene and Catherine O'Hara also took home Lead Actor and Lead Actress, respectively, and Annie Murphy won Supporting Actress. The show first premiered initially on CBC in Canada before making its debut in the U.S. on Pop TV. But when Netflix picked up the show and began streaming seasons in 2017, the popularity of the sitcom quickly spread. We'll talk to two of the stars and co-creators of the show, the father and son team of comedy icon Eugene Levy and son Dan Levy. First up, the legendary Eugene Levy.
Hey, good evening. How are we doing? I think we've used 10 minutes out of my 20.
We have already. We have. Well, it's a long career. It's a long, illustrious career, Mr. Levy.
I think, kind of looking back, it's amazing that so much was kind of jammed into.
Right. How did you get into acting? You know, was it all in college? Were you the class clown? Like, how did you kind of find your comedy chops?
Well, was not the class clown. I sat beside the class clown.
Okay.
And studied him as I'm quoting myself from Waiting for Guffman.
Gotcha.
I always remember a line from Harold Ramis. Dear Harold Ramis,
yeah,
the late Harold Ramis,
absolutely.
Who graced the Second City stage there in Chicago. Who said that he was never the class clown, but he wrote for the class clown.
Oh, I love that.
But, no, I was, I think I kind of developed some comedy chops, although, you know, to me it was just kind of a crazy thing that kind of made me laugh. And I would start writing these odd little bits and pieces, little bits of prose, little paragraphs, mm-hmm. sometimes one line, sometimes a poem. And I put them into a little booklet that I called Poetry, Prose, and Cons. And, you know, so I'd have little things like Ode to a Frenchman. Oui, oui, maintenant, c'est un espoir, comme ci, comme ça. Hee-hee, ha-ha. I'd title something Knowledge, and then I'd put ... So those were, and then those little things kind of got taken around the school. People started reading them and said, oh my God, it's funny. And then they got printed in the school paper. And next thing you know, I'm running for president.
That's awesome. It's dry. It's always dry, unexpected humor with you.
Well, I didn't know really what it was at the time. I think what I was writing back in high school was kind of reminiscent. I'm not comparing myself, but it was reminiscent of a Spaniard in the works, the John Lennon book from the early '60s that he wrote. These odd little bizarre little things, and my pieces were odd little bizarre little things, but I don't know whether I would categorize them as dry back then. They were just odd, but people seemed to like them. And then that's when I realized, and other people realized, that you know, that I was funny.
Well, and the famed Second City Troupe, obviously based here in Chicago, began its troupe in Toronto in 1973 with the likes of Dan Aykroyd and Gilda Radner and Brian Doyle Murray. And the following year included John Candy, Catherine O'Hara, and one Eugene Levy. And that must been a, that must have been an experience of a lifetime.
Well, you know, when Second City started in Toronto, I was that came right on the heels of a musical called Godspell that a bunch of us started. It was our first show in Toronto. Marty Short and myself,
Gilda,
Gilda Radner, yes, who and when Second City, when Godspell, I guess contractually we were contracted for 12 months, and at the end of 12 months, a bunch of the people left Godspell, like Gilda, and went on to Second City, and I stayed in Godspell because they gave me the lead, and I thought, well, it'll never happen again, so I may as well take it.
Yeah.
So it was only 3 months. They opened in Toronto in 1973, and 3 months after they opened, I actually made my way into the into the show. So I wasn't there for the very opening, but I kind of moved in quickly, you know, in 3 months. It was a kind of theater I'd never seen before. It was really exciting. It was funny. It was a review. It was intimate. And it was smart, you know, and I was just blown away and a little intimidated by the show when I first saw it. And, learning to get comfortable kind of improvising in front of an audience took a little time. For me, it was I was petrified the first couple times I went out on stage and, you know, had to improvise. But there were people like Danny Aykroyd, Valerie Bromfield, just insanely brilliant at it. Joe Flaherty, insanely brilliant at it. And Gilda was just Gilda, and she could do no wrong on stage. People loved her no matter what she did.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Did you audition in Chicago, or did you end up auditioning up north?
No, I auditioned in Toronto for the show. Everybody in the Toronto company auditioned in Toronto, and John Candy was the one person that auditioned in Toronto, and Del Close, who was directing the Chicago Second City company, said, no, we want him down in Chicago. So they took John and brought him down to Chicago, and he went into the company with Bill Murray and Betty Thomas, and I can't remember who else was in the company actually, but I know those two were in the company.
Well, I've heard
Ryerson.
I've heard you talk about the car ride you took from Toronto to Chicago, and I don't know if they were trading cast or you were performing in Chicago. You were with Dan Aykroyd and John Candy. How cool was that?
Well, it was pretty cool. We didn't think it was that cool at the time.
Yeah, right.
But you know. It was a luckily John had a car, so yeah, that made it easy and probably saved us some money since nobody else was paying for it.
Right, exactly.
But we went down there, and the highlight of the trip was I think we had a flat on the way, and John ended up changing the flat, and I think I was asleep in the back seat and never woke up. So,
nice, very nice.
Yeah, no kidding. I know. I'm the kind of guy you want on the wagon train, aren't I?
You absolutely are. I've heard you tell the story of the before, too. You know, obviously, you know, they pulled together all this talent from Second City and turned it into a television program, which lasted for years. I mean, this was a great... I remember watching it locally here. I think it was actually on NBC, but... You know, what a talented pool of people. And it all came from your days at Second City in Toronto, right?
Well, the show came out of Second City. SCTV, of course, stood for Second City Television. And, you know, Bert Solins, who owned Second City for years and years and years, when SNL broke in 1975, he was kind of concerned that a lot of the Second City alumni were kind of going over to this, you know, to this new television show, and it hit so big that he said, "Well, we should start our own television show, and so that we don't keep losing people." to other shows. So we started Second City Television, and we got together with a bunch of us, got together, and Del Close, and we kind of brainstormed this idea for, you know, for this television show.
And your film career began to take off, you know, in the 1980s. And, you know, my kids probably first discovered you, and my kids are 13 and 9. You know, you were the key to selling Clark Griswold, Chevy Chase, the Queen Family Truckster in 1983. Yeah. So that's how they discovered Eugene Levy.
Wow. Well, the only thing I remember about that day was we shot it in Glendale, California. It was August, and it was about 132 in the shade.
Oh, man.
That's kind of my memory of the day. But I also remember when Harold Ramis, and I you know, I was watching the Letterman when he first came on. It must have been 83, 84.
Yep.
And Harold was going to be on the Letterman show promoting Vacation, so I stayed up to watch in my bedroom, and he kind of came out on the panel, and the first thing Letterman said was, "How about that car salesman scene?" And I bolted up out of bed. You know? So, oh, my God. They're talking about my scene?
It was classic. It was classic. It really kind of set the tone for the entire movie.
Yeah. It was, well, how funny was the movie? Number one.
Yeah,
it was an amazing movie, and just kind of catapulted you know, Harold up there into the upper echelons of you know, cinema comedy.
Well, we're talking to Eugene Levy, whose TV show Schitt's Creek just swept the Emmys, and there's more with him next on 720 WGN.
Hi there, Ed.
Good to see you, Mr. Griswold. How you doing, Ruben? Right?
Rusty.
Yeah. Okay.
Look at him. He can't wait.
So, spring training?
Yeah.
Guy just took it away a couple seconds ago.
Huh? Let's get to it, then.
Okay. We were kind of afraid the new one wouldn't come in yet. We were on our way to California in the morning, the big vacation, the whole family, Wally World.
Wally World, very exciting one.
Clark.
Well, there she is.
Where?
Right here, the wagon.
Dad, this is not the car you ordered.
Take it easy, Rusty. Ed, this is not the car I ordered. I distinctly ordered the Antarctic Blue Super Sports Wagon with the CB and the optional Rally Fun Pack.
You didn't order the Metallic P?
Metallic P? No, Antarctic Blue. The Sports Wagon. This isn't even the right model.
You know, I think you're right. I don't think this is the car. This is the new Wagon Queen Family Truckster. This is a damn fine automobile. If you want my honest opinion, beats the hell out of the Sports Wagon. But I want to make you happy, huh?
Dave Plyer back with you here on 720 WGN. We're talking to comedy icon Eugene Levy as we celebrate the Emmy sweep of critically acclaimed TV sitcom Schitt's Creek. When you look at your movies and TV shows, and we just played a clip from National Lampoon's Vacation, how incredible is that, that you keep working with all these talented people?
Well, I've been very lucky. You know, I've worked with... listen, it's so you don't know how great it is to be able to work with your friends. It just, and if you're able to do it, and I have been able to do it over the years, it just makes work so bearable, you know.
Yeah.
I've did 5 movies with John, and Armed and Dangerous was one of them, and we. I guess the thing I remember most about Armed and Dangerous, other than having a lot of laughs doing it with John, was that he talked me into doing, you know, I was wearing a pair of kind of leather chaps in that in one scene in that movie.
Yes.
That didn't quite have enough material on the backside. And it was John that talked, and I didn't want to wear those things. I said, no, I can't do that. He said, no. And John talked to me for an hour, basically saying, well, this is the denouement of this comedy stretch in the movie. And it'll cap this little sequence in the movie so well. It'll be so funny. It'll be so great. Comedically, it makes so much sense. You just have to do it. I said, okay, John, you've made your point. All right, I'll go ahead and wear them. And
and it did.
Meanwhile, cut to, we're shooting the scene on Hollywood Boulevard, and there's a crowd of about 400 people on the other side of the street. And every time I see that movie, I think, you know what? didn't have to wear them. I mean, it is kind of funny in a way, but, you know, for me, I've got to live with it for the rest of my life.
Yeah, right, exactly.
But he got, the thing of it is, he did spend an hour talking me into it, and then he had the biggest laugh that I actually did it.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
That's what friends are for, right?
Like a true friend, yes.
That's right. Then he did Waiting for Guffman, which, you know, you starred and wrote the film as well. Again, a successful collaboration with people you grew up with in the business, Christopher Guest and Catherine O'Hara. Do you enjoy being in front of the camera or behind the camera? I mean, you've done both. I mean, what do you enjoy doing?
I think I went through a phase where I thought it would be more fun behind the camera. And, you know, started directing and, you know, because I thought the day would go faster if you've got, you know, more to do. But I found when I was kind of directing a project and, you know, we'd be on a break and I'd look over and see all the actors kind of over by the coffee machine, you know, having a lot of laughs. And I was being bombarded with technical questions about what kind of filter do you want to use
over
the camera on the next shot, and how do you want to light this thing? And I found, I'd rather be over there having the laughs.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, this is not as interesting to me as just having a bunch of laughs with your fellow actors and kind of having fun in front of the camera. So I, you know, for somebody who's really not an exhibitionist, I actually have more fun in front of the camera.
Yeah.
But, you know, I could be one of the bigger enigmas in the business in that regard.
Well, I'll tell you, speaking of fun in front of the camera, after so many other films, fast forward to the late 90s, the American Pie movies, that is the gift that keeps on giving.
Well, listen, you know, who knew, really? It took a lot to get me to do that movie. I didn't necessarily want to do it when I read the script, and you know, my manager at that time just kept saying, "Go in and take a meeting." I say, "Why would I want to be in a movie? I wouldn't go and see. It's really gross, you know." And I understand how kids would like it, but I don't know, you know.
Yeah.
He said, "Well, just take a meeting." I finally went in and met Chris and Paul Weitz, and in no time at all, I realized these guys are incredibly smart with such an acute sense of comedy that I trusted them, and I just said I had a problem with the role of the father as it was written. It had a kind of a crass side to it that I didn't really like, kind of a nudge-nudge, wink-wink thing that the character had with his son. And they said, "Well, what do you want to do to change it?" I said, "Everything. I'd like to start from scratch and change the character." So they said, "Well, good. Come on in. We're going to improvise. Come in on Saturday, a week before we start shooting, and we'll improvise. We'll go through all the scenes and improvise them."
But there's not a lot of people that can do that, Eugene. I mean, that's what makes you so unique and so special, is that people should be able to count on you to come in and put your own mark on it and make it special and make it something that's really going to be entertaining.
Well, I think, you know, at the time, improvising was not, no, let me go back. I think we'd already done Waiting for Guffman before American Pie. Mm-hmm. So we had already kind of, you know, gotten into a nice little rhythm with improvising. But it wasn't so much that I wanted it improvised. It was just I didn't like the character. So in order to, and they wanted me in the movie, so we went in and improvised all the scenes and made them. Jason Biggs and I, and they were really kind of funny, and
they were great.
1 week later, we go in to shoot the movie, and I noticed there are no sides, what they call sides, which are the scenes you're shooting that day. They type them up on smaller pages so you can carry them onto the set and use them as a guide. I said, "Well, I have no sides in my trailer." And Paul and Chris Weitz came back and said, "Oh, well, we thought you'd remember what you did last week you improvised those scenes." So literally we went on camera trying to remember what we'd improvised. But it was a great deal of fun, and, you know, cut to, we're, you know,
four features later. Yeah, in the theaters.
You're the high, and I know there's some direct to video stuff you did too. But this, you're the highlight of the movie. Like the story was about these high school seniors growing up, and you ended. You know, every time I knew you were going to be on screen, I'd get excited because I knew how funny it was going to be.
Well, it really turned out well, and I give Paul and Chris Weitz a lot of credit for, you know, having the patience to go through all those scenes and kind of, you know, redoing them. It really did work out well. And basically, I just wanted the dad to be a dad, a corny old dad.
Yeah.
And not try and be his son's pal.
Sure, sure. Which is the way it should be.
Yeah.
Well, and now you've worked with the amazing Catherine O'Hara for well over 40 years. It must be exhilarating to be able to keep creating fresh, new characters with her.
Well, it's always a challenge. And the thing about Catherine is she's like the one person who can come up with amazing kind of input into her character. We had created a character in the very beginning, which was our take on a former soap star who had, you know, come into a lot of money with her husband. And Catherine came in with her own take, which made it so much funnier than, you know, we had conceived. So it's always an exciting experience working with Catherine because of what she brings to a project.
And it's a really fresh character for you, too, I think.
Well, for me, to be honest, the design for Johnny Rose in this show was to be kind of be a straight man, which I was so looking forward to, in the kind of way that you know, looking back on a lot of classic situation comedies, half-hour comedies. Well, even Seinfeld. I mean, Seinfeld was actually the straight man in his own in his own show. Jack Benny was actually the straight man
true.
In his show.
You,
Mary Tyler Moore was the straight person in her show.
Sure.
You surround yourself with funny people and give yourself a chance to react. And what I love doing as a character actor is reacting to other characters. So it's probably as straight a character as I've done, as close a character to who I am that I've ever done. And I find it really kind of exciting.
It is exciting. Well, you can catch every season of Schitt's Creek, including the final season on Netflix, on October 7th. We'll talk to Eugene's son, Dan, who co-created and co-starred in this award-winning series, next. Eugene, pleasure as always.
Wow, the pleasure was all mine.
Dave Plyer on 720 WGN as we continue our conversations about TV sitcom Schitt's Creek, which swept the Emmys in its final season. Here's the co-star and co-creator of the series, Dan Levy. Welcome in, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, before we talk about this very fun series, let's talk about you a little bit. You know, I know you were very well known to MTV audiences in both Canada and the U.S. What kind of got the acting bug started for you?
You know, I always sort of, that was always my path. I did a lot of theater growing up, and I got an audition for MTV sort of out of the blue and thought, you know, I'm a teenager and could use some cash. and auditioned, not really expecting anything out of it, but more sort of an experience, you know, in an audition room. And I'd like to think that it was because I didn't expect the part that I got the job as a host on TV. I don't really know how it happened, but, you know, being a VJ on MTV is a pretty cool gig, and it sort of took me out of the acting world for about 8 years. So when I left MTV, it was really sort of getting back at something that I had always wanted to do, but had, you know, sort of been pulled out of for a while.
Well, I have to assume that there was a lot of laughter in your house, your father being Eugene Levy, Second City, National Lampoon's Vacation, Waiting for Guffman, American Pie.
Oh,
but
yeah.
But I know you've also given, I've seen you do some other interviews. I know you've given your mother some credit, too.
Yeah, my mom, my dad is a very funny person. My mom is an extraordinarily funny person. So the combination of both of them, it was a nice house for laughter.
I bet. Oh, no, I bet.
Yeah, it also made it really hard when you were like a teenager wanting to get mad at your parents. And my dad would like do an SCTV character and I wouldn't be able to keep a straight face through the fight, which is not good.
No, it's not. It doesn't really get your point across.
You don't want to break when you're mad at your parents.
No, you don't. You absolutely don't. You absolutely don't. But now with this MTV gig, you know, you did MTV Live. You got to interview some pretty cool people, I would assume.
I did. Yeah. It was, listen, it's one of those things that I never saw for myself. I never saw television hosting, in my future. So to have been given that opportunity and then to be able to sort of interview some people that I had grown up really loving and, like Gwen Stefani was a big one for me, no doubt, growing up with like the be all and end all. And, it was a very surreal way to spend my 20s.
I bet you.
It was amazing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a dream come true. Who were some of the other standouts that you said, wow? Because, you know, in this business, because I find this too, you've got some really great, warm, talented, just lovely people to interview. And then there's some that are just painful. So give me some of the standouts that you really said, wow, you know what? I've admired this person from afar, and they're more fabulous talking to them in person.
Kelly Clarkson was a big one. I know that that's sort of a given because everyone really enjoys Kelly Clarkson.
Sweet,
but,
yep.
I think ultimately, anyone who's risen to the top, any A-list star that's out there right now is there because they're very good at what they do. And that's not just like, acting or singing or performing. It's also the way they treat people, the way they handle themselves in a professional setting. Like
so
those
true.
Are all sort of important things that help us, a sustainable career. Adele was another amazing. I remember, I had been in London and listened to Adele's first record and knew she was coming to tour in Toronto. This was when 19 came out.
Mm-hmm.
And turned to my producers at MTV and I said, you need to book this girl. She needs to come in. She needs to sing. It's incredible. And at the time, MTV was like, if you weren't Sum 41, you weren't playing in our, our studio.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
So I pushed, pushed. And eventually we got her on and she performed and I interviewed her. And after the performance, it was like you could hear a pin drop. And it was the first time that a lot of Canadian audiences had heard about Adele. And then obviously from there on, it was just the rest was history. But
it was cool to sort of experience
the beginnings of these people's careers.
Yeah, I was going to say, you had a feeling for this person that they were going to kind of become something special.
You could tell just from the way that her voice alone commanded the room. It was something extraordinary was happening. And no one really knew what it was at the time.
Sure.
And now it's all, of course, unfolded.
So fast forward, talk to us about the original vision for Schitt's Creek.
I think way back when it started, I came to my dad with sort of a seedling of an idea. And that was just essentially a show that explored a wealthy family that lost their money. And I felt like at this point, we're so versed in how rich people live their lives. It's the housewives, the Kardashians. We have such a fine-tuned understanding of how wealthy people live at this point.
And you've seen some of this up front. With these after the shows, you've seen some of these people up close. I mean, so this is something you firsthand experienced, yeah.
And, I thought it could be really funny now that we all know how these people live to do a show that played on that understanding. What would happen if they lose everything? And my dad and I sort of played with that premise for a while, and one thing led to another, and Schitt's Creek was born. So, and then soon after that, we did a little presentation pilot, a 14-minute little, half episode, and got a full season pickup based on that. So,
And it airs up in Canada, and then you add it on Pop TV here, which people got to find Pop TV because it's the former TV Guide Network. I'm telling you, folks, you got to find it and see the show because I'm seeing all the advertisements for the season now.
It's going to be great. And then season one, if people want to catch up on that, it's on Amazon and iTunes and
all over the place.
A bunch of different ways they can find it as well.
Now you turn to your dad to co-produce the show with you. How has that experience been?
It was great. I mean, ultimately it's such a gift to be able to go to work every day with your family. And in our case, we get along well. I guess that could have gone in a different direction.
Sure, sure.
But, you know, I think we have such a similar vision for the show that it's made it really easy. And, you know, obviously he brings so much experience to the table, and I've been able to learn from him, and I've been able to sort of sit back and learn from the way that he works with Catherine. It's ultimately just been like, you know, a masterclass in comedy that you just can't buy.
Yeah. No, I was going to say, your dad and Catherine O'Hara have known each other for over 40 years. They worked together in Second City. Even before that, I think they worked together. And, you know, the funny thing is, as many roles as they've played together on stage or in the movies or wherever it's been, these characters are so completely different. This is such, first of all, it's such a character-driven show, which is so reflective of what Second City is all about to begin with. Talk to me about some of the characters that make up your family for those who haven't seen the show yet.
Well, Catherine and my dad play Moira and Johnny Rose, who are, you know, Johnny was a video store magnate, and Moira is his soap star wife.
Yep.
Who has, you know, the most incredible delusions of grandeur.
Fabulous wig collection.
An amazing wig collection that she prides herself on. She's named each and every wig.
That's hysterical.
And together they birthed two incredibly incompetent children who are in no way capable of standing on their own two feet. And essentially that's where our show starts. That's sort of the... you know, where we start with this family who has been stripped of all their money, and they've, you know, ended up in this town that they had originally bought as a joke because the town was called Schitt's Creek.
Right, right.
And, you know, when they went through their back tax scandal, the only thing that they were left with was the town. So, you know, it's funny how it came full circle. But that's where they start off.
Yeah, your character is fabulous. Your character is fabulous. I mean, it is funny. Your character is fabulous. I mean, it's like part man, part kid, part old lady kind of a little bit. It's like it's just,
I get the old lady thing.
Yeah,
there's an old lady somewhere deep down in David.
Okay.
And I think ultimately he's just a byproduct of this culture where everything is like throw money at the problem.
Yeah.
The kids having sort of social hard time fitting in socially, throw money at the problem. Like, you know, he wants to start a gallery, throw money at the problem.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's really sort of, that's the struggle.
Well, 6 seasons, 80 episodes, and the final season of this Emmy sweeping show will be available on Netflix October 7th. Daniel Levy, great talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me.